Now we are concerned with crafting, with designing, with being pleasing. In this last leg of persuasion, we could consider several principles: arguments, audience, application, arrangement, adornment. These are all principles that we should be considering as we're crafting the sermon. I hope you're convinced that you need to spend time working on this. But I'll confess to you, even though I'm committed to taking all these steps, I think they're all necessary. Sometimes it doesn't look quite as balanced in my practice as it looks like in this picture. Sometimes my preparation looks more like this. Can I get an amen? Golly. Yeah. For me, all this is that exegesis, you know? And then sometimes it can be just rushing when it gets to persuasion. Again, you may have a different inclination than I do. Maybe this side where you're spending all the time being really detailed and careful is more on the persuasion side of the crafting, but you kind of neglect the study and the exegesis. You need to know where you're likely to neglect, and I think we should all work against neglecting any of these steps, because to be a faithful preacher, we have to get the text right. We have to get the text right, but we also should be concerned with getting the text across. So today, I just want to talk about one of these steps along the last line of persuasion. How do we get the text across? And I want to think about the principle of arrangement. This is something that you, I think, inherently do as a preacher. It's something you do in other areas of life as well. I thought about how we arrange meals. So when it's dinner time in the bishop house, I call all my kids together. I'm the main cook in the house. So I'm going to get in there and I'm going to cook, and they're going to do the hardest thing they can do well. And so for them, that's getting stuff together. That's arranging things for me. So I get all the kids out there and I say, beef, rice, chicken stock, garlic, bacon grease, large skillet, and then they all scatter. And the idea is, 2 minutes later, I'm walking into the kitchen, and I'm hoping everything is not only out, but everything is in its place. Chefs call this mise en place, things in place. I don't want the butter on the stove. And sometimes you have to teach the kids, don't put the butter on the stove. It's all melted by the time we need to use it. I'm going to use it over here. So when I want to reach for it, I want it in its place. For a meal to be enjoyable, it has to be arranged. And for a message to be nutritious, to be enjoyable, it also has to be arranged. Now, why do you think it's important to think about how you're going to arrange your sermon? Do any of you think it's important to give this consideration? And if so, why?
So people can follow you?
Yeah. And why is that important?
You want
them to pay attention and learn something. And we're not like English professors. We're preachers. So So we want them to learn something. We really care that they get it. We want to get across. So they have to pay attention in order for this thing to get across. We desperately want them to get this. Anything else? Makes you more persuasive. Yeah. If there's no arrangement, or it's scattered or illogical, it's hard to follow, it's going to be hard to get. Anything else? Yep.
To be clear, because you're giving something that's new to their brain. Hmm.
Man. That's really good. And I was thinking about this morning with Samuel. You're in the study Monday, maybe Tuesday. You've been hitting this for days. It's day one for them. It's new to them. And it may not feel new to us at all. We're so familiar with it. We've forgotten the arrangement of it, how this fits together and how to make the points. We've got to really intentionally try to make sure it's going to be clear to them on the first time that they hear it. Yeah, it's important. You could say if you don't do it, it's unloving. It's unloving. We want them to get it. And it makes sense that we would arrange it in such a way where they can. One man said, by carefully arranging our sermon, we are like the consummate general who secures his victory even before the fighting by the careful method in which he takes his positions and arranges his battalions. Well, what's the principle of arrangement? The persuasive preacher, the preacher who wants to persuade, who cares that his audience gets the truth, intentionally arranges his sermon to make his argument. Can you see how this relates to your worksheets? The persuasive preacher wants his people to get his argument. He wants to make an argument. That's number 5 on your worksheets. The main point you're preaching, or the argument, to your audience. Well, that's related to number 7, where we're asking for a title and you to consider how you would arrange the points. We intentionally arrange our sermons in order to make our argument. Let me give you a picture. Do you know what that is?
Triangle.
Here we go. It's a good start to the day. Okay. It's an arrowhead aimed at a target. The target is the heart, the bullseye is the heart of your audience, your congregation, and you want to sink the head of the arrow into that bullseye. What's the problem right now with the picture and my goal? I've got an argument. I've got an arrowhead. And I've got a congregation. And I want them to get the argument. What's the problem? There's no fletching. This shaft of the arrow is arrangement. It gives weight to the arrowhead. It balance to the arrowhead. And force and substance. It lines up the arrowhead toward the target. It is necessary in order to bring the argument, in this case, home. Well, what is it as a preacher, what is it we're actually arranging in our sermons? Like, what would you say are the parts of a sermon?
Parts of the passage.
Okay. So, is that kind of like an outline? Is that what you're saying? Basically, or points?
The structure of your passage. Yeah. Mapping onto the structure of your sermon.
Yeah, so the points, homiletical outline. Good.
A good introduction and conclusion.
Okay. An introduction. And conclusion. Anything else?
Tension.
Okay. Tension, what's that?
So creating like a question in the mind of the audience that you're going to answer, or like creating some discomfort for them so that then that gets resolved like by the end.
Okay. And why do you want to do that? Why do you want to create tension?
To keep them engaged.
Yeah.
To show the relevance of the passage for their lives.
Good. Good. Do you want to consider tension and how that helps you to make your argument? Anything else that goes into a sermon that you would want to arrange?
Illustrations.
Illustrations. And where they go?
Applications.
Applications. Yep. Maybe the gospel. Aaron says maybe. Anyone here yesterday morning? Yeah. I think it's a good answer, Aaron. I say go with it.
It seemed like you mocked me.
Well, sorry. I was more mocking than maybe. Yeah, the gospel's got to go somewhere. So there, you can see there's several things that when you're putting together a sermon, that you're thinking about, where do I put these things and what order do they go? What part of the sermon should I put it in? Well, Aristotle simplified all the different parts that I agree with. You know, I'm thinking about all of these things and arranging them into my sermon. Aristotle simplified our understanding when it came to stories, and he just gave three things. A story is made up of three things: a beginning, a middle, and an end. And you could map that onto a sermon and just say an intro, the body, and the conclusion. Now we're going to consider how we fit these other things into those sections. But let's just talk simply about three sections. First of all, the introduction. How do we arrange the introduction? We consider the goal of getting attention. I'm just going to propose that's one of the things we should try to do in the introduction, is we should arrange it in such a way that it gets attention. What are ways you can do that? What are ways you can get attention?
Pose an intriguing question.
Yeah. Good. Ask a question that is going to interest the congregation. Any other ways you guys try to get attention in an introduction? Yep.
Tell a story.
Very good.
I was gonna say make fun of yourself.
Make fun of yourself. Yeah. Anyone not do that ever? Make fun of them, maybe? That's probably better to make fun of yourself. You were right. Okay. Let's get it. It's get, I should say, interest as well, in addition to attention. Depending on your audience, you know, they may be into that sort of thing. Tell a story. Use humor. Hopefully, that's endearing and not necessarily insulting. I can struggle with that. Sorry. A question that piques interest, a surprising statistic, but we want to gain attention. Ryan Topping, in his book on rhetoric, refers to this as having a hook, a line, and a sinker. You need a hook to get the attention of your congregation. But what do you? What's the hook for? Get attention for what? The main idea. Yeah, remember the principle. We intentionally arrange our sermons to make our argument. We connect the hook to a line. So the main point. That's what we're trying to win attention for, is the argument. We're not just trying to be transitioning from the music part of the service, or we don't want just to feel better about what we're about to do and to calm our nerves. We want to get them to laugh. We don't just want them interested in us. We want them interested in the argument. So we're trying to hook them somehow to the argument. So you might even state your argument in your introduction. You don't have to. If you use a main point, I do, you can give it to the congregation at different points in the sermon. I would just say, where is the most impactful place to give the main point? Often it can be in the introduction itself. We've got a hook. Got a line. We need a sinker. What does the sinker do in fishing? It brings it down to where you want it to the target, to the fish. So it's the weight that brings the argument, and it carries it all the way through. So I'm going to encourage you to think about doing something else, and it's set expectation. Set expectation in the introduction. Get attention, set expectation. That could be just laying out the organization of the passage. This is how we're going to go through and make this argument. I think this is the most flexible part of preaching, is how you do this. You might be explicitly stating what your homiletical points are. I've got 3 points and here they are. You could just be drawing attention to structural shifts. Like a few weeks ago, I preached Ecclesiastes 3, and I said, I think there's 2 parts to the sermon. And we see the shift when the poetry turns into prose. You could be even just general. This passage gives us 2 reasons for why we should believe the argument. But the point is, set an expectation, give them organization in order to serve your argument. Now, what we're going to do in this instruction is we're going to look at a copy of the sermon I preached yesterday. I've put it on your tables. That's not because the sermon was good. This is just because we're all familiar with the sermon. So we all heard it, and so we're just going to use this as an example to consider these elements. So, look with your partner at the sermon manuscript and try to find where I, in the introduction, tried to get attention and to set expectation. Try to find that in your, or with your partner. All right, guys, let's come back together. Just looking at the introduction itself and looking for these 2 things, a hook, getting attention, and getting attention for the argument. I'm trying to get your attention, or I tried to. I tried to get your attention, try to pique your interest in what the whole thing was going to be about, which was my argument. Could you find any ways in which I was trying at least to do that, to get your attention? Yeah.
Brother, do you ever wonder, am I going to make it?
Yeah. Yeah. I was hoping that you guys would resonate with what I was admitting, that one, home is awesome. God's home is awesome. And I wonder if I'm going to make it. Any other ways?
Getting our attention by
admitting. Yeah, the surprise of it. Anything else on getting attention?
Both in my mind.
Yeah.
Like you're getting our attention,
yeah.
But also setting the expectation that we're not going to go there.
Right. Good. Yeah, I didn't want you to think that we were just going to spend time doing that. I told you I didn't come here all this way to talk to you about that. I did come here all this way to tell you this. So then I dropped the line, right? I'm trying to gain attention for the line and dropping the line. Anything else I did to set expectation that you can see of what we were going to do in that time?
You said there were two answers in Revelation 7.
Yep. Yeah, so again, different ways you can do this, but I just said there's two answers. Good. Okay, so get attention and set expectation. That's what we're aiming to do in our introductions. Let's move on to the second section, that middle section of the body of a sermon. And I'm gonna propose that in this section, very simply, what you're trying to do is develop your argument. You've stated maybe your argument. You know your argument, at least. In the body, that's where you're primarily developing your argument. And one way to do this, not the only way, but one way to do this is through your homiletical outline, through your homiletical points. Let me say something about homiletical points in their relationship to number one on your worksheets, what you saw as the exegetical structure. They should reflect what you saw in the structure. They don't necessarily repeat what you saw in the structure. Certainly, the structure should influence your decisions in your homiletical outline. There are times where I deviate from the structure I saw exegetically. I think especially in stories, they just are communicating truth differently than other kinds of passages. In stories, particularly if I'm using like plot arc, my homiletical points don't end up being, now listen, congregation, I've come to tell you the setting, first of all. And then point number two, you know what we're going to talk about now is rising action. Now we're getting to the climax, which is not the same thing as a resolution. Let's do some falling action, point number five now, or whatever it is. And then there's the denouement, or whatever, the stasis, the new setting, or whatever. So there are reasons to deviate from your exegetical structure. I would say you should have a good reason to do it. Normally, it might really map onto your exegetical structure. But your homiletical points are an opportunity for you to develop your argument. So, homiletical points. Just a few suggestions. Make them true. What I mean, make them true, like true to the text. Make them really reflective of what the passage is, or the verses that you're covering. They have to be reflective first and foremost of being true to the text, but then make them pleasing to the ear, simple, something they can latch onto. Why? Not to make yourself look so crafty and impressive, but because you love your people. And if this is helping make your argument, you want them to believe it. So spend time thinking about, how do I make it pleasing? But then also they have to be distinct. They're not just the same. They're related to one another, but they should also be distinct. Now, just take a moment with your partners, again, looking at the document. My argument in the sermon was God gets all his own all the way home. That's the argument I'm trying to develop with my homiletical points. I've also got a title, We're Gonna Make It. Find my homiletical points with your partner and answer these two questions. How do they relate to my argument and title? How do the points relate to my argument and title? And then secondly, how do they relate to one another? Take a couple moments with your partner and try to answer those questions. Good question. My homiletical points, I'm talking about the outline itself, the points. You can look at the subpoints as well, but the points. Point number one, point number two. All right. I just want to acknowledge again the awkwardness that I'm just putting my sermon in front of you. Like I don't feel amazing about it. The only point of this is talking about these things. Let's just look for how we could do it and think about then how you could do it. So what were my homiletical points? Remember I said I had two answers to how God gets his own all the way home. What were the two answers? What was the first one? The living God sealed his own. What was the second one? The Lamb of God leads his own. Can you see how those are related to my argument? How so? They're the how. How does he do it? Yeah. Any other ways they're related? What's that? Yeah. Yeah. It explains how he can, we are his own. It identifies them. Yeah. Yeah. Good.
But I think you also alliterated it to make it simple so they can remember it.
Yeah. So my main point, God gets all his own. And then I try to use God and his own in each of them. Any other ways you see they're related to the title and the argument? You see the relationship between the argument and the title? God gets all his own all the way home. We're going to make it. So I've heard just questions about whether we use a title in our sermons or not. That's up to you. I think if you have a title, it's best to use it rather than it just being the thing that fulfills the requirement of the media people who need something to put on the slide or the person printing the deal, and it just gets on that piece of paper and that's the only place it ever is. Or you say it in the beginning and then you never touch it again, like Joel Osteen with the Bible. If you have, like, if you work to make them relate to one another, use it. Okay, what about how those two points, point number one and point number two, can you see how they're related to one another? And if so, how? Like, how are they alike? Yeah. Yeah, and how are they different? Good. Great. Sealed and leads. Yeah. How else are they different? Yeah. God's action, the Lamb of God. So they should be related. They obviously belong together. They should. And yet they're distinct. They're doing two different things. Do you think that they help develop the main point? Do they help develop the argument? Even just as they're phrased. Yep. So it's an effort to do that. Now let's talk about something else we want to have in the body of the sermon. Something else we do to develop our argument. We consider our homiletical points. And we also, I agree with Aaron. Let's consider the gospel. And maybe. I'll give you a maybe. Maybe it's in the body. Maybe it's in the body. It should be somewhere in the sermon. But maybe it's in the body. Anyone remember where I preached the gospel in the sermon?
Your analogy about stains.
Yeah. The Lamb of God leads his own, and one of the things the Lamb of God does is he cleanses his own. He makes them clean. So that was in point number two. Where should you preach the gospel in your sermon? Wherever it's most effective. What do you mean by effective?
When it best serves the overall structure, I think.
Yeah. 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 Great. You've got to find a place for it. And I would really encourage you to think about where it goes. So we talked about this with Revelation chapter 6. You could talk about the gospel in multiple places. Consider where you're really landing it. I think it matters. I was in a workshop last week in the book of Ecclesiastes, and throughout the passages in Ecclesiastes, there's all this frustration about and vanity of life, and there's a discomfort you feel even as a preacher preaching about how awful life can be, how hard and frustrating life can be. And the inclination is to let them off the hook and bring Jesus in here as quickly as possible. The problem with that is you're crucifying the point of Ecclesiastes. And the other problem is you're not making Jesus look as great as he really is. So it's possible to bring him in too early because of your discomfort or not wanting them to be uncomfortable. Or bringing him in too early because you can validly do that and yet you've lost any tension, which is important, I think, in the preaching and making your argument. So preach the gospel in the place where it helps your argument land the hardest. And sometimes it'll land harder if you wait longer. So oftentimes you'll be preaching the gospel in the body. It may be better to do it in the conclusion. But consider where you're going to preach the gospel. Okay, there's something else, though, we need to do in this body in order to make our argument. We don't just develop it. We have to defend it. We have to defend our argument. Consider how you can do that in the body of a sermon. Preachers, I really believe that John Stott image of we're a man between two worlds. We're speaking on behalf of heaven, and it's like we're kind of floating up there because we're between the world of heaven and between the world of earth, and we're God's spokesperson to God's people. There is a monologue element to expository preaching where we are holding forth the word of the Lord for God's people. It's a monologue, and yet it is also dialogical in the sense that we aren't alone in there, and we care what they're getting, we care what they're hearing, we want to take into account what they're thinking and how they what obstacles there may be to them believing this argument. So defending our argument is about raising objections and then refuting those objections. Let me give you three, even diagnostic questions you could add to your worksheets and turning your worksheet into a sermon under number 5 of my weekly worksheet. I have questions like these. What questions does my argument raise? When I phrase it like this, God gets all his own all the way home. What objections or questions does my argument raise? Number 2, how might believers, faithful believers, struggle specifically to believe it? Number 3, what objections would unbelievers raise against my argument? Now, you guys are probably still writing. Okay, so questions that the argument raises, ways that believers would struggle to believe it, objections unbelievers might raise about my argument. And I'm not looking at every verse in my passage when I'm doing this step. I'm looking at my sentence. Now you can do the other thing. What questions are they gonna have about this word or this verse or whatever? But this is specifically about the argument. Okay, so take a moment with your partners and just try to find one example of an objection I raised and then how I tried to defend my argument against that objection. In the body of the sermon, just try to find one objection I raised and how I tried to refute it. All right. Were you able to find an objection that I was anticipating and raising? Anyone find any of that?
Maybe like I'm not good enough to make it. Mm-hmm. So when you talked about us being cleaned by the blood of the Lord, mm-hmm. like his purification.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I was just being honest, like sometimes in that, at that point in Revelation 7, right after verses 9 and 10, salvation belongs. It's this high, high moment where the confidence we should have that we're going to make it is based on the fact that God is going to make sure all his own get all the way home. And then the passage turns to those who get home are made white by the blood of the Lamb. And they get there out of the great tribulation. So I'm trying to figure out, okay, how do I move from this to that? And an honest struggle that I have is I can believe God is going to get all his own all the way home. I sometimes struggle to believe, am I actually one of them? And the reason I struggle with it is because I'm so sinful. So how do I reconcile the guarantee of salvation with my ongoing struggle with sin? And then we're into the blood of the Lamb. So raise objections, but you have to refute them if you're going to defend your argument. If your argument has to stand up to it. Now, one piece of feedback that Samuel helped me with yesterday was what I didn't do was talk to the guy in the room who doesn't struggle like I do, who doesn't worry about his sins like being the obstacle and maybe being reason why he's not going to make it, or who doesn't really think much about getting all the way home. It was a helpful point. So let me add a piece to this. You raise objections. You also need to recognize obstacles. And what I mean by that is what I didn't consider is the obstacle of pride. That's just off the top of my head at this point. Maybe they're not going to get this argument because there's this obstacle to caring about it or seeing the wonder of the passage. So recognize obstacles to them taking home the argument, and then raise objections and refute those objections. This is audience work. You've got to consider your audience because you're considering what would they struggle with in accepting this. What that means is if you change the audience, you have to consider different objections or different obstacles. Does that make sense? So I was intentionally thinking of preachers. And I think a lot of what I did could apply to Christians, but I was also doing preacher stuff. Let me change the audience, but not the argument. So the argument for Revelation 7 is God gets all his own all the way home. Let's just stick with my argument. But I'm going to change the audience for you. Imagine you're trying to bring that argument home to the hearts of teenagers who you are leading on a youth ski trip. A youth ski trip. Teenagers. And you're doing a devotional on the top of the mountain. And you're just using Revelation 7. Use my argument. And just talk together with your partner. What objections might they have about accepting the truthfulness of that statement that are specific to teenagers in that kind of situation, a mix of believers and unbelievers? Or what obstacles might they have to really owning it? Okay? Just discuss that with your partner. Youth ski trip. All right. Let's just share this together. You're leading teenagers on a youth ski trip. You've chosen Revelation 7. You've got an argument to make. And you want to defend that argument against the obstacles they have to believe it and the objections they would raise against it. What obstacles or objections might you address?
I'd rather be skiing.
Yeah, than sitting here talking to you. Yeah. And how would you defend your argument?
You might die skiing.
Hey, that's an unhelpful comment because I'm going on a ski trip next week. with families in my church, and I'm like struggling to believe this. Like, what I want this to mean for me is I'm gonna make it to my house afterward, and not die falling off the ski lift or running into a tree, like, for real. But I need to hear the other piece of, hey, but if you die, you go home. Like, you know what I'm saying? So
that might be how, like, I might try to, like, build up Revelation 6 or 5, I'm sorry.
Just to, like, make it more attractive. And yeah, good. What else? Wow. Yeah. Yeah. That's wonderful. That would have been helpful for me to do yesterday, even with y'all. Like, we come out of different homes, and home may not be a word that's a good way of, like, looking just at the sentence. What one of these words or phrases might they struggle to believe? Well, this home, God's home, it's a home where there aren't tears, there isn't hunger, there isn't thirst. God himself, as the perfect Father, will take away all those things. Great. Anything else?
I've got a lot of life left to live.
What's that?
I've got a lot of life left to live.
Yeah.
What do I think about this now?
Yeah. How would you defend your argument? Yeah.
Who knows if even driving back to our physical home.
Right.
I guess not guaranteed we'll make it there safely even.
Right. Right. Yeah, you think about the angel when he turns to John, who are these who make it home? And he says, you know. He says, these are the ones who came out of the great tribulation. So sometimes we need to help them to see that home here is a troublesome place. And you may think it's great, but your eyes need to be open to what's going on here. You actually don't want to stay here. You want to come out of this to a better home. One more.
At bottom, I think a lot of students object that God only gets his own
home. Yeah.
Doesn't everybody go to heaven?
Good. Excellent. How would you defend your argument?
Well, close. Verse 9 says there is a huge multitude from
every nation. Yeah. 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 Excellent. Good work, guys. Okay, let's, with just a few minutes left, let's turn to the last portion, which is the conclusion. Wrap up. The conclusion. We need to not just stop talking when we're done preaching. We need to complete our argument. We need to complete our sermon. Wrap up. But nothing new. Give them a final view of the argument, but nothing new. Wrap up. But then also, ramp up. Ramp up. Don't just wrap up. Ramp up. This is our last chance to press into the heart the sharp point of the arrow. We want to have urgency. Earnestness. Now, how that feels and looks may depend partly on you, but mostly on the tone of the passage and the urgency. But we want to press it home. We don't just restate kind of our main point. We want to heighten the rhetoric. Now, how might you do that? Like, if you want to ramp up the argument at the end, what are just some quick examples of how you could do that? Questions? Yep. That leads to a personal commitment, a choice, whether they're going to commit themselves to the argument. Yep.
Talk to their heart.
Yes. Good. Talk to their heart. This needs to matter to you, and you need to devote yourself to this. Yeah, you can... I mean, there are different things. You can pile on exhortations. There can be a heightening even of your voice, a lowering of your voice. But but consider, how do I ramp up? Now, just last thing, look at what I did in my conclusion, and just try to find how I wrap up and how I ramp up. Just take a moment with your partner to do that. All right, let's just talk about ramping up. How did I ramp or try to ramp up the argument in the conclusion? Yeah, that was my attempt to try to get a personal commitment. We know the answer. Revelation 7 gives us the answer. God's going to get all his own all the way home. The question for you is, do you trust him to get you home? And that there's a pretty typical pattern in my own preaching that I need to break more. I mean, I'm often ending on a question. I do think it's helpful. But I would like more variation in the way that I ramp up, but try to ramp up your argument in the end. Well, back to the relationship between messages and meals. As a cook, I've messed up a lot of meals. And for example, if I make scrambled eggs, if I didn't get the plate out in time, I'll burn the devil out of my eggs, and it's just disgusting because eggs go from perfect to nasty in seconds. So I needed the plate out to be ready to transfer it, or you just ruin it all because I didn't have things in place. And messages can get ruined if you don't put the things in place. So as an act of love, consider your arrangement before you preach your sermon. Principle is the persuasive preacher intentionally arranges this sermon to make his argument.